Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. Welcome aboard, everybody, to the Mother's Day Best of Midrats. We're reaching back into the archives today to 12 March of last year for our episode on China with Dr. Donald Henry and Dr. James Kraska. So kick back, give a nod to those who brought you into this world, and we hope to talk to you real soon with our next live episode of Midrats. Have a great Navy Day. This week's topic will be China. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. With me is my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and hopefully a little bit more, we'll have Gowron from Information Dissemination join us for the conversation. So kick back, enjoy yourself, and thanks for joining us, whether you're with us live, getting the archive from Blog Talk Radio, or downloading the podcast from iTunes. For those of you who are listening to us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page and join us live with the usual suspects in the chat room. Eagle One will be riding herd on the chat room, so if you have some questions, observations, or points of improvement, please add it to the chat room, and Eagle One will fold it right in for us. Our guests today are two China experts. We're going to bring on board Dr. Donald Henry and also Dr. James Kraska. Our first guest will be Dr. Henry. He attended Harvard College with a degree in economics, and after he worked for a year at the National Security Division of the Congressional Budget Office, he went on to Stanford University, spent a couple years there to wind up with his PhD in economics. He followed that up with something I know all the listeners should be familiar with, the RAND Corporation for 18 years, took a little break for 3.5 years, to get some active duty naval service time. Most recently, he has been with the Office of Net Assessment and the Office of the Secretary of Defense for 8 years as a political appointee. He also is a captain in the Navy Reserve and an intelligence officer. He's been studying China and East Asian security affairs for more than 25 years. While working at the Pentagon, he was a key player in drafting the Pentagon's annual China Military Power Report. And Don, welcome to Midrat.
Start off a little bit about China.
Yes, sir, it's good to have you on board. Just to start us off real fast, why don't you give us a quick overview of where you think we stand here in early 2010, and as we're looking across the Pacific at China as she continues to advance economically and also expanding some of her military capabilities?
I think we should look at the last 15 years and look at sort of the major trends. Chinese military power has expanded greatly. Some of the quick details. Chinese have upended the traditional nuclear balance between the United States and China, where essentially they had a small force but not a survivable force. Now they have a larger, growing, and survivable force. So they potentially could engage in an extended nuclear war with us. They couldn't previously. On the conventional side, they've done a lot to hunt our power projection capabilities throughout the region with a concerted anti-Axis strategy, developing weapons and systems and methods of operation, which are targeted at our primary systems of operating around the world. They're developing their own power projection capabilities. A lot of those are on tips of missiles, different than ours, but still nevertheless capable of doing a lot in the region. And they've seriously eroded our traditional advantages in space, intelligence, and information. While doing this, they've been deceptive and secretive about their military programs. And to make matters worse, the U.S.-China community has been very slow to respond. Anyone who is very espouses a view that they're very worried about China is marginalized by the Chinese, saying that you are expressing a China threat theory, which is not true. Most experts in the United States have a pretty benign view of China, and I've heard many times China will only become an enemy if we treat it as one. which has the advantage of possibly being true. However, if the Chinese have already decided we're an enemy, it's a horrible strategy. The key question I usually ask most of the China experts who are reluctant to see China as a growing threat is, what would the Chinese have to do in order for you to change your mind about the benevolent nature of China's military expansion? Most of them won't answer because they're not sure the Chinese won't turn around tomorrow and do it. And that alone, I think, means that a lot of the analysis and the minimization of the China threat is driven more by ideology than facts. I'm not saying China will become a threat, but I think we have to look very carefully about the possibility of China being a threat. Ignoring that possibility is very dangerous going forward.
Yeah, I've always looked, you know, whether you're looking at China or anybody else, the old axiom that you don't judge somebody by their intentions, whether what you think they are or what they say they are, but judge them by their capabilities. And if you look at some of the efforts they've made recently, there's been a lot of discussions about their works on the anti-ship ballistic missile, or that they're expanding their submarine forces and doing nice incremental steps that would give them that anti-access ability and what they would perceive is their backyard. I always look at it that they look at the seas around their waters the same way we look at the Northwest Atlantic, the Northeast Pacific, and the Caribbean. Where do you think they've made the best gains, not theoretical, but actually sitting there pier side or on the ramp from that anti-access capability?
I think if you look at the anti-access capability, none of the individual parts of it are necessarily problematic. The anti-ship ballistic missile program is a major concern, but by itself, there are ways to defeat it. However, when you look across the board, you have anti-ship ballistic missiles, you have surface-to-surface missiles, you've got a Chinese fleet which has longer-range missiles and air cover now, which it didn't used to. You have land-based air which has longer-range missiles, and you've got land-based air defenses, which essentially will target anything flying at a certain altitude across the Taiwan Straits and even beyond Taiwan. So overall, when you look at the system of systems, the change is significant. Our ability to operate with impunity near China's coast is gone. The question is what would happen in a conflict, and I don't think either the Chinese or we actually know. And that's one of the dangers. The Chinese are buying systems and buying capabilities. And quite honestly, I have more time in combat as a naval reservist than probably any Chinese officer still serving. The last time they were in combat was against Vietnam in 1979. And buying the capabilities alone might make them think they have more ability to carry out certain military operations than they do, which leads to a dangerous situation. The Chinese have capabilities which could hurt us, but they might think they have the ability to prevail when they do not, in fact.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I have a question concerning, I mean, the Chinese have developed in a lot of different naval areas rather rapidly. One of the ones that's concerned to me is mine warfare. Can you discuss that at all?
The Chinese have always had huge inventories of mines. We're not sure the extent of that, but we know the numbers are astronomical. The approaches to many of the harbors are mined. The thing is, when you get out to open ocean warfare, the mines become less of a problem for us and for them. When they were coastal navy, that was probably much more important. But floating mines on a large ocean generally are either detectable, avoidable, or you miss them just by luck.
Kind of a similar vein, and China has always, if not good, they've at least been adequate at reverse engineering everything from the aircraft to some of the ships that they build. I think another area, you look back, what was a real eye-opener for me as a mid-grade officer was in the 1990s with, I believe it was Loral Systems, there was a lot of technology transfer for their rocket and missile programs, and also what they're getting through their espionage, what they're getting open source, or even what they're buying from the battlefields around here for our weapons that are duds, in essence. One of the things that is curious about the Chinese, do you see an area indigenously where they have really moved beyond reverse engineering and have developed an indigenous capability that's self-sustaining to develop their own technology and perhaps even a better technology on their end?
I'd say I'd be most worried about Chinese advances in information warfare. The sort of things they do day in and day out, probing defense networks and so on, we wouldn't consider doing that sort of thing unless we were actually at war with a country. They are very good at getting inside computer networks and spying electronically, perhaps in the time of conflict disrupting such networks. Again, that's the sort of capability when you're talking about the information domain. You really can't test until time of conflict. And again, I'm worried about the Chinese being perhaps overconfident that certain things they'll do will work. When you combine that with their ability to deny us information flows that are key to the way we fight wars, that is one area where I think they have indigenously succeeded. I wouldn't look at the Chinese entirely as doing things by reverse engineering. I remember hearing that Cisco was very concerned about a Chinese router, which did the same as a Cisco router. So the Cisco bought one, and we're going to pull it apart and then claim the Chinese were violating all their intellectual property and shut them down. They were even more worried when they found out the thing was not based on Cisco intellectual property. It was indigenous Chinese intellectual property, again, in the information area.
I guess the few decades of sending their best mathematicians and engineers to the U.S. and Europe to get their study has paid off a bit on thinking a little more inventively and developing things on themselves as opposed to just doing, this is a nice copy, let's make one just like it. Eagle One, do you have a point?
Well, I was going to follow up with the information technology. I know in the past, Dr. Henry, that you'd written or discussed with someone about the concerns you had about the network-centric warfare that we seem to be so focused on. And what happens if you can't use that? Would you like to talk about that now?
Sure. We have developed a way of operating which, I hate to say, use a musical metaphor, but it's more of a concert than a single instrument playing. And it requires coordination. It requires intelligence information that's collected by one set of systems being transferred to some other place, processed, and transferred to other locations to be acted upon. It requires command and control from various locations to be passed without problem to various operating units. All these things can be disrupted. And one of the few ways, for example, that can't be disrupted is the old naval signal flags. Of course, the Navy recently got rid of its signalmen. So the only communication system we think is relatively hard for the Chinese to disrupt and almost impossible for them to intercept, we no longer use. Anything that goes over the air is potentially vulnerable. And this gets back to, if we're operating in the Western Pacific, the Chinese have a automatic advantage. They can keep stuff that's internal inside China on landlines, on fiber, that is relatively hard to detect, and we're operating on the airwaves. So the potential for conflict in the Western Pacific place of the Chinese advantages.
I think you just walked into an area that, you know, we talked, you think it's strictly military forces, you're talking about sea denial. I think denial is the key. You see a lot of the Chinese effort in information denial, network denial, and when we go back to as late as the late 90s, you could walk into a radio room and you could do everything from the very beginning of, you know, IT-21, pulling stuff down through a very thin pipe, but with SHF and EHF IP connectivity, you could do it. But you also had HFTTY as a backup. And if you put on your red Chinese hat and you look at what we as a U.S. Navy talk about, it's network-centric this, network-centric that. We've become exceptionally reliant on satellite communications, satellite information transfer, satellite imagery, not just using the military satellites, but really leveraging a lot some of the commercial bandwidth that's available out there. So when you look at what you mentioned before with Chinese strength in cyber warfare, which I think as an institution we've recognized, you know, we standing up 10th Fleet and all the other actions we've done, merging the two in the sixth shop to try to get a better focus on that. But they've also demonstrated, the Chinese that is, a hard kill capability from an ASAT. Do you see when you're talking with ourselves and our allies where we really appreciate the fact that we need the backup and the backup, that we don't allow ourselves to be blinded because we put so much effort into relying on those IP satellite connectivity paths that really are very fragile?
But it's not only a question of redundancy and extra capacity, which is important. The question is, have we got backup methods of operation? Can we fall back on the way we used to fight wars, which you can do over a small pipeline, even HF pipelines, to get information across that actually will allow us to continue to fight? Right now, we are very good on graphics and PowerPoint presentations and orders going back and forth by email. And that is not the environment we might actually have to fight in. And we've spent much too little time thinking about what can we do if the systems go down? How do we continue to operate? What sort of things already should be out as far as information on carriers, on cruisers, on destroyers, before we get in a conflict, because we might not be able to pass that information afterwards. One example is amphibious group used to go to sea, they'd go with pallets and pallets of maps of all the areas around the world they might go to. Now they depend on downloading and printing the maps they actually need. Now that's economically efficient, probably. However, if you wait to download when you're already in trouble, you might not have the bandwidth to bring down that information. So we've moved away from areas which are where we had the ability to continue to operate in an information-denied environment, and we haven't practiced those skills at all, or not nearly enough.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I'll take one of Gauran's normal points. I think last week he was talking about, or sometime in the past, he was talking about the Chinese use of the Internet for their purposes and how it poses a challenge for us, and that we can't take down the Internet to break up their communications, which they might use adverse to us. Would you like to comment on that?
We are very reluctant to deal with the Internet. A lot of our infrastructure rides on it. And just by the type of nation we are, we have sort of an open structure. The Chinese have spent a lot of time and effort to control what flows on their information channels, partly because they are afraid of what would happen domestically, maintaining control over possible domestic dissent and coordination of such dissent. Part of it is to keep news from the outside from coming in, and part of it is a very good defensive shield to cut their information systems off from the outside world in time of conflict. I don't know where we'd even begin to do such a thing in the United States. We're using the same systems for military communications that are vital for any sort of commerce.
The defensive nature of that, there was back in early February, AFCEA and USNI had their West 2010 conference, and kind of their kickoff speaker there was General Cartwright. And Admiral Dorsett was also there. And a theme that kept bubbling up there, I heard again about a week ago over at the Heritage Foundation. They had Department of Homeland Security Undersecretary Rand Beers in, and he spent a lot of his time talking about cybersecurity as well. And that theme was brought up again. The theme that really bothered me, because I heard it from both uniformed and civilian people who are really focusing hard on it, is they're really emphasizing a defensive deterrence. And it bounces around in my head. I have never seen in the history of conflict where defensive deterrence has worked well without an offensive arm. And DHS, their take is, we don't do defensive, that's all DOD. And one of the disturbing things that I also heard from General Cartwright is the military is looking at like, okay, this is strategic infrastructure, so we're going to treat it like strategic infrastructure. We're going to control it. But there was still a great, rightfully so, a great uncomfort with going offensive, because if a cyber attack is going towards you, and if it's done right, you don't know what country it's coming from. It may look like it's coming from nobody, and you think that you're attacking one system, but you're actually in a different nation. Do you also sense this really reluctance to step forward and be a little more aggressive in the cyber offensive as opposed to relying on defensive deterrence?
That's one area where you've got to worry about what actually is going on. My guess, and it's completely uninformed, is very little offensive is going on a day-to-day basis. There's very little retribution against anyone who intrudes upon our systems and disrupts those systems. However, by its very nature, we keep that very closely held. So very difficult to say, but my impression, and again, uninformed impression, is we're doing very little on the way of offensive. And if you look at what the Chinese are doing day in and day out, they're practicing their offensive skills on our real system every day. I doubt we are at the same level of expertise on their systems.
Eagle One? Okay, if Eagle One seems like he's having a little trouble finding the microphone, let me go ahead and step in. Another line is, if China continues to expand and their economy continues to expand, they're very focused, obviously, on resources that any economy goes. And you look at their sea lines of communication to get to Africa, to get to the Middle East. It all goes right through the Indian Ocean. And after over half a millennium of being out of the Indian Ocean, the Chinese are coming back there. And at the same time, while India is rising as well, how do you see India's view of China as their really localized sea denial force starts to reach the ability to go into the Indian Ocean and to interface with some of their economic ties there?
I think one of the big question marks is what will happen with India, both as a nation overall and economically. And in many ways, they have the chance to certainly develop much further than China has. China's economic development has been phenomenal. India, if they did it right and without the same sort of information impediments that you see inside of China, which slow down the economy, and the same sort of control that remains by the Communist Party there, India's got the possibility for a huge economic boom that would dwarf China's. Unclear whether that will happen. It requires a bit of political will and decisions, which the Indians have flirted with but haven't necessarily made. On the military side, Indian military capabilities are significant, and the Indian military force could provide an impediment to China coming into the Indian Ocean. From the Indian point of view, they're looking at Chinese actions, and they see China involved in former Burma. They see China involved to the north. They see China involved in with Pakistan. And they see themselves in many ways encircled by the Chinese. So they're beginning to worry, and while India's military focus has been and will probably remain for a while Pakistan, they're getting very worried about what the Chinese are planning. And if they do remain worried and they build the systems and capabilities that come from that worry, that could provide a major impediment for the Chinese reaching out into the Pacific, Pacific and the Indian Ocean.
Eagle One.
The Chinese have joined in the anti-piracy effort off Somalia. Do you have a feel for how much of that, to what extent that might be intelligence gathering as well as just international cooperation?
I'm always suspicious of the Chinese because they traditionally have not been involved in that sort of effort. I remember after the tsunami in Indonesia, the only thing the Chinese really could bring to the table was genetic testing to try to help people relocate, people they were separated from, but that was in many ways a boon to them. They have a huge data bank of DNA now, which they didn't previously. I think the Chinese are watching. I think they're legitimately interested in preventing piracy in that part of the world. But they're also watching how we operate, and they're gaining experience operating themselves, all of which are important for their military potential.
And, Don, as we come near the bottom of the hour, I wanted to kind of, as we do most of the time, we talk about China. It's very U.S.-centric focused. But two of our greatest allies in the area, at least in the Northwest Pacific, are the South Koreans and the Japanese. Is there a disconnect, or do we largely have overlap and agreement with the South Koreans and the Japanese on how they view China? I know there's a lot of ongoing territorial friction, but does that kind of fold into our same concern, or do they have a little more of a pragmatic view of China?
I think the Japanese view of China has become very similar to our own. The view in the Republic of Korea is somewhat different. And I've talked to Korean officers who will say, we for centuries have known how to deal with China. And I think they are they're seeing that China, particularly if Korea ever unifies at some point in the future, China will be either a maritime neighbor for South Korea or a land neighbor of China. And they've got to reach some sort of working accommodation with China. I don't know what that is, but I think they're looking forward to the time when they have to deal with a large, economically and military powerful China. So I think if you look historically, Korea tends to find a way to live with China, and Japan traditionally has been a major rival of China. And I think both are reverting to historic type.
And Eagle One, do you have the last question for Dr. Henry?
Okay, I noticed somebody's raising the question of the Philippines, and I know you've done some work in looking at that. How much did we lose when we lost our bases in the Philippines?
I actually did a study, but the focus at the time was how valuable are the Philippines against the Soviet Union? Remember, the time frame was back in 87, 88 or so. And at the time, the Chinese were actually closely working with us on many aspects of countering Soviet expansionism around the world. So, unfortunately, we looked at it solely through the prism of the U.S. versus the Soviet Union. If we looked at it from the point of view of China, we lost a lot. Having additional air bases in the area, having port facilities would have been extremely helpful. Right now, if you look at where our access is, we've got access in Japan and then back towards Guam and then Australia with a little bit of access for our fleet in and out of Singapore. So our ability to sustain operations in the Western Pacific is greatly reduced, and the diversity in number of bases is way down from the loss of the Philippine bases. It's unfortunate it happened, but when we gave up our presence there, the Filipinos wanted us out. We always said we'd go if they did. The Philippine government had very either completely unmeetable demands or they exorbitant demands, and we were focused on the Soviet threat. I wish we could play that game over again, but we can't.
And here on a regular basis, a lot of people wish they could have that liberty back in Westpac as well, because that's kind of dried up.
As a senior naval officer, you look at junior naval officers and tell them about liberty in the Western Pacific, and they just look at you like you're a creature from the medieval ages.
Yeah, I don't know whether we could ever have a mid-rat episode where we all tell Philippine story, but that would definitely be an interesting topic. Dr. Henry, we have immensely enjoyed having you here today on Mid-Rats. Thank you very much for taking time out of your Sunday to come join us, and I hope to hear from you again in the future.
All right, thank you.
Thank you,
yes,
Dr.
sir.
Henry.
And just as a quick reminder for everybody, you are listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio of Mid-Rats. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, and my co-host today is Eagle One of Eagle Speak. For the second half of the hour today, we bring on our second guest. Second guest is Dr. James Kraska. Dr. Kraska is a commander in the United States Navy, though I think he is just here as James today. He serves presently as the Howard S. Levy Chair of Operational Law at the U.S. Naval War College. He holds appointments as a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and is also the guest investigator at the Marine Policy Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He has both a research doctorate and professional doctorate of law, having earned a master's in international law and a JD from the University of Virginia, also a JD from Indiana University, Bloomington. Commander Kraska also has earned a Master in Arts in Defense and Foreign Policy from Claremont Colleges and has a diploma of the College of Naval Command and Staff at the U.S. Naval War College. James, welcome to Mid-Rats.
Thank you, Sal. It's a delight to be with you.
Hey, we really appreciate you as well taking some time out of your Sunday to come join us. I would really be failing myself if I didn't come out of the box with this. I enjoyed back in the winter edition of Orbis, you had an article you put out provocatively titled "How the United States Lost the Naval War of 2015," and what I enjoyed most out of it was some of the reactions from people that came there. And I'd like to take one of those reactions for you and roll that up into my first question. Is Thomas E. Ricks, he responded that, and I love the way he put it because it really raised the hackles in the back of my neck. He said, quote, "Does national security rest ultimately only on the Navy, as this hydrocentric article tendentiously asserts?" I think he just coined hydrocentric as a word. We can use it here. But I go back to something that's been a guiding light in my life. That's The Princess Bride. And a little bit of advice in that movie of never getting involved in a land war in Asia. I think when you look at the problem of China, if it goes kinetic, if you're not focused on Navy and if you're not focused on Air Force and how that can bring about the type of effects that you want to achieve, you're in a load of trouble. So anyway, let me throw that your way and see what your angle is.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, would very much like to maybe in the future have some sort of debate or discussion with Tom Ricks. He's just wrong in his skepticism. Global order rests upon sea power, and it's always been that way. To the extent that Rome encompassed the known world, there was only a Roman peace or a Pax Romana when Rome was able to control all of the Mediterranean. And they only could do that back then by controlling North Africa, the Levant, Asia Minor, which is now Turkey, as well as Italy and Greece. And in doing so, since oared galleys couldn't go very far from shore, they couldn't take sort of a high seas approach to sea power. And it's true in the West as well. I mean, in the modern era, which begins roughly with the Treaty of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War in 1648, all of the world's foremost powers have built their power based upon the exercise of naval power and in a sense of global order. First, beginning with the Dutch, which used sea power as a means to outflank the Spanish, which had Spain had a superior land force, and the Dutch outflanked them and became the dominant sea power. And Spain and Portugal tried to keep all of the rising powers, particularly the Dutch and the British, out of their areas. They divided up the world in the Treaty of Tordesillas, and it was blessed by the Pope, and their goal was that Spain and Portugal would control all of the new world as well as Asia. And the up-and-comers were able to exploit sea power better, and so that's why the Dutch and then the British very quickly displaced the Portuguese and the Spanish, even though they were extracting large amounts of wealth from the new world in the form of gold and silver specie. And then the United States also inherited that role. You know, Walter Russell Mead mentioned something quite interesting in his book Special Providence, and it's true, and that is that really only the United States and Great Britain, and I might add to that the Dutch to some extent, were the, and this is an Anglo-American axis, so to speak, are really the only countries that were concerned with global order, not just security or protection around their particular country. So I think that, you know, respectfully to Tom Ricks, he's cut his teeth as a ground guy and done a lot of good work on that, but he just doesn't understand sea power.
Eagle One.
I have a question. I enjoyed an article you had, a small piece you had in Foreign Policy back in March of 2009 after the USNS Impeccable was assaulted by the Chinese, and you discussed China's use of maritime lawfare in there, and I think one of the quotes I really liked was that you said that the event marked the first test of the Obama administration regarding China's effort to reshape the international law of the sea. I wonder if you could expand on that and discuss how that looks today.
Sure. China, unlike the United States, has a collective vision for what oceans law and policy ought to look like. And then they implement that vision. And this is essentially the DIME approach, the diplomatic, informational, military, and economic approach, in which all levers of government power are focused on the same thing. And you heard a lot about it from the excellent discussion that that we just heard. The United States doesn't have that sort of collective focus, and China would like to solidify and expand their vision of anti-access and area denial in Asia and the East China Sea. The goal is to decouple the region from American power, to disconnect the United States from Japan in particular and its allies, perhaps India as well. And so they have, not only are they pursuing all of the technical strategic initiatives that we just heard about, but they're coupling that with this term that was most often attributed to General Charlie Dunlap, an Air Force JAG, which is lawfare, which is the use of law as a method of warfare. And this fits in with Chinese theory, Chinese strategy, grand strategy, in which they combine both the legal dimension with the psychological dimension and the diplomatic, the public diplomacy dimension, in order to change or convert public opinion. And in Asia in particular, public opinion is particularly vulnerable to these sorts of approaches, because there is an undercurrent in Asia, in society, even in Japan, as well as Korea and China, Southeast Asia, that is that a foreign presence doesn't necessarily belong there. And there's a psychological hurdle that has to be overcome. There is some doubt about the presence of outsiders or Westerners there, and China exploits this, and they exploit it in their lawfare. So they tested both the Bush administration, if you recall, in early 2001, I think it was January, when they intercepted an American EP-3 maritime patrol aircraft, surveillance and reconnaissance aircraft, that was flying about 75 miles off the coast of China, flying in international airspace. And due to an aggressive interception by a Chinese fighter jet, the aircraft, the EP-3, was damaged, had to make an emergency landing, and the fighter jet and the Chinese pilot were lost at sea. Well, it's no coincidence that soon after President Obama took office that they tried the same sort of thing, but this time on the surface. And that was the incident with the USNS Impeccable that you just mentioned. The goal is to pressure the United States as well as her allies to fall back and provide a greater standoff distance from China, making us uncomfortable to operate there, and also to raise public opinion against the presence of what they would like to portray as a provocative patrols by U.S. 7th Fleet. The USNS Impeccable incident also occurred about 75 miles off the coast, and that was in China's exclusive economic zone. But the exclusive economic zone, under the Law of the Sea Convention, has the character of high seas, except for purposes of economic exploitation, principally fishing. China is joining with a few other countries in trying to convert the exclusive economic zone into something that looks much more like the 12 nautical mile territorial sea.
Is that a reason for us not to join in the Law of the Sea Convention, in that it's too easily bent to such an argument like the Chinese make?
It's a difficult question. I mean, it could be a mid-rats all on its own. I think that the Law of the Sea Convention is in the interest of the United States. Just like any international institution or any treaty, you can have a disagreement. In fact, you ought to expect disagreements about interpreting the provisions of the convention. You have to remember that the convention is a product of the U.S.-Soviet Union bipolar cooperation. Most people don't realize that it was the United States and the Soviet Union, then with Gorshkov as a rising maritime power, that twisted arms of allies and associated states in the communist world as well as in the Western world, largely going against the interests of the Group of 77 and the Non-Aligned Movement, which were represented by China and by India, in making sure that the Law of the Sea Convention provided generous navigational freedoms under the water, on the air, in the air, and on the surface. Now, of course, China feels that now they have sort of a greater chance or greater authority to reinterpret or sort of relitigate those old arguments. China's been saying the same thing for 40 years. It's just that only in the last decade, have they felt confident enough to begin to take action at sea to try to repel Western warships, principally U.S. warships as well as Japanese. So I think that the convention is in our interest, just like I believe that the UN Charter is in our interest, but that doesn't mean that suddenly you join the United Nations and other countries don't try to bend it and twist it, in a direction that is counter to peace and stability, because they will. And so what this means is that we can use the Law of the Sea Convention, we can use the UN Charter as part of our, as an instrument of our struggle, as you know, Hans Morgenthau talked about a struggle for power. And we maintain a struggle for power because we believe that the world ought to be a peaceful, orderly, safe place where conflict is avoided. And one of the dimensions of the struggle for power is the struggle to shape the law. So whether we join the UN, which we've already done, of course, or we join the Law of the Sea Convention, that's not the end of the story. That's just the beginning. So the bottom line is, I think that we're better inside the convention than we would be outside of the convention, but it will, if we join or if we don't, it will require constant vigilance against those who would try to reinterpret or reshape the convention against our interests.
James, Sal again, I like how in your opening remarks you went back to the Romans and some of the historical precedents. Though the times change and some of the nations change, a lot of the issues repeat themselves on a regular basis. And the Chinese apologist school, the ones that kind of have the Hello Kitty approach on dealing with China as they get stronger, one of the things that you'll see them bring up on a regular basis is they'll come back and they'll say to you, well, you know, 100 years ago you had the Royal Navy and you had this other country coming up called the United States, and they both work together and exerting sea power all over the place. And I always find when they bring that up it to be highly irritating, because when you look at the United Kingdom and America, you have the mother country and you have the country that still is based on common law. We have a lot of, even though our largest ethnic group is German, we are in essence part of the Anglosphere, not just from a language but from a cultural standpoint. We have a long history of interactions. We have a similar world view of things. The Chinese, their history goes back thousands of years. As I'm sure you've experienced yourself, you sit down and you talk some Chinese, and the Boxer Rebellion happened yesterday. The Opium Wars were the day before yesterday. They'll go back a few thousand years to talk around their culture, and I believe the comment you made about the South Koreans having hundreds of years is exactly how they view these things. What is the best way to counter that argument when people tell you, don't worry about China, it's just like the Royal Navy and the American Navy 100 years ago?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues. I mean, first of all, the United States and Great Britain, as well as the Netherlands, emerged from a very liberal, small L, very liberal culture of Anglo-Saxon American freedom. And so we have a view of the world which is based upon, which informs everything from human rights to international trade, which says that people ought to be free to engage with other people. Countries ought to be free to engage with other countries without interference, and they should only be minimally prohibited or not prohibited at all unless their actions affect the rights of some other country or some people. So you see this reflected in the common law in Great Britain. Well, there's a very different sort of view which emerged in the West on the continent, and it's reflected in the Napoleonic Code, which is that they want to create a utopia on Earth, and the only way to do it is to prescribe everything that can or should be done. And it's reflected in France, it's reflected in Germany, and it was reflected in Russia, and of course it took on a Marxist appeal and made its way to China. And this sort of view is at odds with a liberal order. So the United States and Great Britain have maintained world order because they thought that it was good for promoting their own security, their own place in a peaceful world. China has the goal of creating a world, at least a Pacific, but more likely a world, that promotes the interests of the Chinese. And it's not a liberal vision. So it is at odds with sort of an Anglo-American view of world order. I think that's the I mean, that's really the main difference. You know, if Beijing had a government that was like the government of the Netherlands, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Eagle One.
Well, that leads right into a question I was going to ask you. The International Crisis Group has a piece out that was on recently in the Christian Science Monitor on why the Chinese are dragging their feet on UN sanctions against Iran, and they're pointing out that the longer China holds out, the more good things get promised to them, which I guess would lead right into the idea that what's, you know, China's view, as in most cases in countries around the world, China's view is what's good for China is what really matters.
Absolutely. And, you know, as part of that, we've already heard, I mean, China hopes to spread its vision of the law of the sea and of international law generally as one of the components, along with media warfare and psychological warfare, so the legal warfare component, out to the first island chain, which runs along Japan and the Philippines, and then the second island chain, which runs out into the Marianas and Guam. And they would like to become more so the hegemon of Asia. And in doing so, they're promoting a fiat-based order in which they call the shots. And in particular, with regard to the law of the sea, they're willing to employ or use any sort of theory. They have kind of this rotating mannequins on trying to reshape the law of the sea in order to provide China with the legal authority, at least in the minds of the Chinese, which is more important to them than the minds of the Americans, the legitimacy to do what they're doing. So they're willing to couple with European efforts to create marine sanctuaries in this area, in which they claim that the use of sonar damages their living resources. And the effect of all this reverberates well beyond the East China Sea, because it encourages other countries that frankly don't have quite the energy or the hostility that China does, but still are susceptible to this fiat-based order, particularly in the law of the sea. And these are the rest of the BRICS. Both Brazil and India have also held the same view that China does. And Russia, I believe, is really the key. I think that Russia we could engage with Russia on bringing Russia in to this Anglo-Saxon-American project of global order based on sea power. Now, that's a far stretch, and some people would laugh and say it's just not possible. It may not be possible, but there is little other choice. Obviously, India is also an option, and because they're a Commonwealth country, maybe that might bear more fruit.
When you look beyond the direct military aspects of it, lack of a better phrase, soft power, economic power, when your opponents or competitors play by a different set of rules, it can be challenging. For instance, the Chinese don't have the laws that we have or some of the cultural barriers that we have when it comes to corruption. And when you look at, for years, the economic play that they have in the Panama Canal, also it came out in the last few months that the Chinese are partnering with the Egyptians to develop an economic opportunity zone that just, happens to be at the southern approaches to the Suez Canal. And you look at a lot of the other resource areas that they've moved into that I don't think, from a naval perspective, are perhaps critical in some of the nations of Africa, but when it comes to access to strategic minerals and other types of extraction industries, your inputs there. But when they bring in their businesses, they bring in their business practices and the role that they can have from a influence into these local nations' political systems. Does it also leave the possibility open that in case of some type of crisis or challenge with the Chinese, that there is a soft kind of anti-access or sea denial that they can do via their influence on other nations?
Absolutely. I mean, in East Asia, it goes back to spreading the view or the perception that everything would be fine if the Americans wouldn't conduct operations in areas where they, quote, don't belong, that is, in East Asia. And there absolutely is a soft power aspect to the law of the sea. As I mentioned, both in Europe and in the United States, the governments largely lack a strategic perspective on the oceans. Whereas China understands the importance of the oceans. And in China, for example, let's look at both, this is a nonpartisan issue. In the Bush White House and the Obama White House, the National Security Council is not the lead for U.S. oceans policy. The lead for U.S. oceans policy is the Council on Environmental Quality, which is the White House Office for the Environment. So that person chairs the committees that develop U.S. oceans policy. And the result of that is that we have our own anti-access area denial problem. It's very difficult for the United States to promote freedom of navigation in the East China Sea when we create a 150,000 square mile marine sanctuary out in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands that stretches 1,200 miles and is 100 miles wide. When we create a zone in this area, in this instance, purportedly to protect coral reefs, and then push for pressure other countries and push for either suggested or mandatory ship reporting, there's really no difference between that and countries that ask for prior consent in order to enter their exclusive economic zone. And these examples are noticed by other countries, and then they can be used. And the result is that the very areas that tend to be the most environmentally sensitive with marine ecosystems are the littoral areas, and particularly the equatorial littorals, littoral areas, the ones that both the Marines in Marine Corps Vision 2025, as well as Thomas Barnett and the Naval War College folks talk about, that run along the equator, that are the likely areas for future crisis scenarios. The British Lord of Admiralty has said that in the UK, this is sea blindness, that we've been blinded by ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we presume global mobility despite all of these tools of anti-access and area denial, everything from high technology to low technology sea mines to the lawfare, media, and psychological warfare that that China has really mastered.
You know, James, that's the sea blindness. We had on a previous episode of Midrats, we had a Canadian on here as a piracy expert. And over at the Canadian War College, you're having a very similar discussion about that sea blindness. And I think that is part of the problem that we have with China, is the fact that people are focused, rightfully, I guess, elsewhere. And I think that's that was one of the good things about the article that you had in December, that you ruffled the right feathers, that you drew some people to some subjects that need to go there. We're down to 50 seconds, so I just wanted to take one last second, James, to say thank you very much for coming and joining us on Midrats. We really enjoyed having you, and you really added some good depth, especially from a legal perspective, to the discussion.
thanks very much. It's really been an honor to be with you. When you contacted me about being on the show, I was actually at that very moment listening to the session, I believe it's 9 or 10, that featured Dean Barney Rubel from the Naval War College, who's actually my boss one layer up, discussing sea control. So it's there's some irony there, and I think that it shows that MIDRATS is really becoming an important and well-known outlet for naval power. I really appreciate the effort you guys are doing.
Well, thanks again for the kind words there, James. And I would invite everybody who's listening to us to please join us next week. Our topic is going to be the U.S. Marine Corps Enforceable Entry. Our guests will be USNI blog co-host Ultima Reggio Regis and also Dakota Wood. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Again, I'd like to thank both of our guests today for coming on, everybody in the chat room and listening live. Hope you have a great Navy Day.
Wants to marry me and so leave the strand and